We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session Thursday, January 19th, 2017, to consider the matters entitled Secretary of Labor versus Consolidation Coal Company, docket number VA 2012-0042. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, and Commissioner Alphen. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith. Morning, Rory.
Good morning. This proceeding concerns a citation that was issued by the Secretary of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration to Consolidation Coal Company for a violation of its roof control plan. The citation alleges that Consolidation Coal's Buchanan Mine No. 1 violated its roof control plan when it took a cut of coal that was greater than the 20-foot maximum limit the plan imposed when adverse roof conditions are present. After a hearing on the merits of the citation, a commission judge affirmed that the plan was violated, but vacated the citation's significant and substantial designation. The Secretary of Labor filed a petition for a review of the judge's decision to vacate the S&S designation, which we granted. The citation was issued on July 14, 2011. On this date, MSHA Inspector W. Gregory Ratliff arrived at the 17 Wright Development Panel while miners were bolting the final cut of coal in a cross-cut connecting the two entries. He observed a large crack in a bolted portion of the roof and noticed that rock had fallen from the roof. Inspector Ratliff measured the most recent cut to be in excess of the 20-foot limit imposed by the roof control plan. Accordingly, he issued a citation for a violation of 30 CFR Section 75-220A1, the safety standard that requires compliance with the mine's roof control plan. As stated, a commission judge concluded that the mine violated the standard, but the violation was not S&S. Specifically, with respect to our S&S findings, the judge concluded that the extended cut contributed to a discrete safety hazard of a roof fall occurring due to the extended span of unsupported roof at the intersection. However, the judge found that the secretary failed to prove that the hazard, that is a roof fall, was reasonably likely to result in injury. Therefore, the secretary failed to prove all the elements of the Matthews test for S&S. Accordingly, the judge vacated the S&S designation. The judge stated that it was not reasonably likely that the hazard contributed to would result in injury. She cited the roof supports provided by the Automated Temporary Roof Support, or ATRS, that was in use. In addition, she noted that company policy prohibits miners from going under unsupported roof. Furthermore, the mine was using a tighter bolting pattern in the crosscut. The judge also stated that under continued normal mining operations, the roof would have been fully supported within a short period of time, and therefore, the miner's exposure to the hazard would have been brief. On review, the secretary asserts that the judge improperly relied on the presence of redundant safety measures and further erred by improperly assuming the exercise of minor caution. The secretary states that the commission should reverse the judge and find that the violation was S&S. Consolidation Coal maintains that the judge did not err in her analysis, and that her findings are supported by substantial evidence in the record. I can take any questions that you may have.
If there's no questions of Rory at this time, Commissioner Young has agreed to start off the deliberation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Rory, for your able preparation and management of this case. I intend to vote to affirm the judge in this case on substantial evidence grounds. I know that we're in a time of some turmoil in terms of the definition and understanding of S&S, but I think that there's been some settling post our decision in Newtown and following on the Fourth Circuit's decision in Knox Creek, that does reaffirm that in order for a violation to be S&S, there is some calculation that has to be made or some determination that there is at least some likelihood of an injury-producing event flowing from the contribution that the violation makes to the hazard in question. And I think that the way you express the hazard must take into account the contribution of the violation. If it were not so, in this case, as in every roof fall case, I think you would have to find S&S per se, because as the Secretary explained, and I don't disagree with this, Roof Falls are a significant and historically very dangerous threat to minor safety and health. Furthermore, when you talk about the particulars, hundreds of pounds of rock falling on a minor are certainly likely, were that to occur, to result in serious injury and probably a fatality. But you can look at this, I guess, by way of analogy, and consider that in the longwall mining operation, there are massive root falls every day. They're not S&S because they're planned. It's planned subsidence. It's in an area where there aren't any miners. The mine plan takes all of this into account. And the fall of the roof is a relatively inconsequential matter in the vast majority of situations involving a longwall mine. Here, when you have the continuous miner, you're looking at a situation where deep cuts were prohibited, and deep cuts are commonly understood. This is a limitation that arises again and again at 20 greater than 20 feet. When you look at something like 20 feet, you do recognize that, as we've discussed before, there is a permissible degree of arbitrability or arbitrariness, pardon me, in how the government chooses to express things. There's nothing magical, probably, about 20 feet. 20 feet is a distance that's settled upon with an understanding that there has to be some margin of safety to account for the fact that it's not going to be perfectly 20 feet. And in fact, in this case, after extensive cross-examination, the inspector essentially agreed with the operator's counsel that a 20-foot cut is going to expose an area from the rid line to the end of the cut that's greater than 20 feet. And in fact, it got him to agree that it could be at least 22 feet. Routinely, the inspector was very resistant to going beyond 22 feet, but you have the judge's decision finding that in this case, the cut was somewhere between the 22 feet asserted by the operator and the 23 and a half feet asserted by the inspector as the minimum. Now, the inspector said it was probably 26 feet, but if you're in that range, and that the judge found, and substantial evidence, I think, supports her conclusion, that it's somewhere between 22 and 23 and a half feet. At 22 feet, you're at the point where the inspector is even telling you, okay, that wouldn't necessarily be a violation. I don't think you can have that if there's not a violation that's an S&S violation at the same time. So you really need some greater degree of explanation on the part of the secretary to establish what the hazard really is. And in this case, the hazard is not a roof fall, because again, if the hazard was roof fall, it's S&S every time. A roof fall is a fatality producing event. And when you talk about the possibility that a miner is going to be exposed to that, it's going to be S&S if that's the hazard. But the real expression of the hazard takes into account the contribution of the violation. And the expression of the hazard in this case, I think, is the chance that this 2 to 3.5 foot variance in the roof control plan would contribute to a roof fall that would expose miners to danger of being struck by falling material. I think when you get into the particulars of how this case was argued and decided, some of the things that have been argued by the secretary are almost a distraction to me. I think that when you look at the redundant safety measures that are asserted in this case, I would probably agree, and if my colleagues can demonstrate to me that I'm wrong about this, I may change my position, but I would probably agree that the tighter bolting pattern and the ATRS would be considered redundant safety measures if that was the crux of the case, that was the pivot on which the case turns. I don't think it is. In particular, what you're looking at are things that are part of the mining environment that should be considered redundant safety measures if you're relying on them to protect miners in the failure of the primary protective measure, which is compliance with the roof control plan here. I think that when you look at the nature of the violation in this case, considering the relatively small deviation from the roof control plan and the evidence that was put in about the possible hazards, the best argument the Secretary makes, and I think it is an argument that I thought hard about, was that as you're in proximity to an intersection, the stress on the roof may increase. But you have to consider, I think, and this gets us into how do you really take these factors into account, that this is a roof that is under a greater degree of stress to some extent than was intended because it exceeds the parameter set by the roof control plan. But at the same time, it's being properly controlled by the tighter bowling pattern, which does, just as a practical and logical matter, make it less likely that the roof is going to fail. Now, the reason you don't count these as a legal matter, and I understand that, is that the tighter bolting pattern might not have been correctly executed. The ATRS might not have been correctly employed by the miners, or they might have abandoned the protection of the ATRS in some way. But when you look at how they talk about things like that, in this case, it's not apparent to me that the danger of the roof fall was the threat to miner safety and health that the Secretary asserted. The one thing that I think is actually the largest distraction is the idea that, and I would agree with the Operators Council here, that that there is some reliance on minor caution to avoid exposure to the hazard. I don't see that here. The reason they were talking about the red zone of the miner, if you read what the examination of the witnesses was getting at, is that because of the physical dimensions of the miner, you would be a long way from exposure to the stressed area of the roof. In any normal operation of the machine, in any normal collection of methane samples using a probe, you have the margin of safety that I've talked about, and then you have the actual physical margin that the miners are going to be beyond in the continued normal mining operations of this mine. So I think when you take all of that into account, the judge was justified in finding that the Secretary, who has the burden of proof here of removing these doubts, did not find them sufficiently removed. One thing that I have a problem with, and I've seen it more and more, and I just want to comment on it. We've seen the Secretary bring things in, not cases, which are obviously, you draw an analogy from a case that's been decided by the commission or a court. That's clearly proper to bring before the commission. But things such as accident reports or other things that are reported on MSHA's website or published in a publication, and instead of being introduced via a witness and subject to cross-examination at trial and exposition of the issue so the judge can have a thoughtful presentation of it, they're brought in afterwards as though we can take them into account and attach some significance to them without that kind of opportunity for thoughtful evaluation at the hearing level. And I would hope that we would discourage that. I know that the Act and our procedures permit hearsay testimony and evidence to be employed, but I believe that you really need to have the opportunity for evidence that's brought in outside of the normal protections of the rules of evidence at least has the opportunity to be questioned and probed during the hearing. So I don't really think that we ought to consider or attach any weight at all to these accident reports or other matters that are sought to be introduced by the Secretary. In finding this case on substantial evidence ground, I will say that the judge could have decided it the other way, that there is substantial evidence to support the contrary view, and I considered it. I just believe that on balance, you know, we employ our judges to use their wisdom and to evaluate the evidence and assign credibility to witnesses, and that we ought to be respectful of that. We're required to be respectful of that. And in this case, that compels me to vote to affirm the judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. Commissioner Alphin?
Thank you, Chairman Jordan. I agree with my colleague, Commissioner Young, so I don't have to repeat what he said, except to say the same thing in slightly different words. At our law firm, I probably mentioned before, at our law firm, we used to talk about the magic of litigation and, the bunny in the hat. The magic's not pulling the bunny out of the hat. The magic is putting the bunny into the hat. And I think the magic the Secretary tries here is by calling this a de novo legal review, when in fact it's a substantial evidence review. So they try and push it off onto these legal issues of redundant safety measures and all. But I think Commissioner Young eloquently made the point that in every case involving S&S, the judge has to make a factual evaluation in the light of the extent of the violation regarding whether the violation is reasonably likely to result in a serious injury. That's a factual decision the judge has to make based on the evidence as whether looking at the extent of the violation, it's reasonably likely to result in a serious injury. And the Secretary, therefore, in this case, bore a burden of showing by a preponderance of the evidence that the circumstances of the violation, that is 2 to 3 feet deep cut, was reasonably likely to result in a serious injury. The judge simply found that the Secretary didn't carry that burden. The judge concludes the Secretary has not established that a roof fall was likely to result in an injury in this case. So the judge, she could have gone the other way. She could have gone the other way, but she didn't. She found they didn't carry the burden of proof. And a review of the evidence in my mind shows that is certainly supported by substantial evidence, although maybe a negative. It's hard to say negative is supported by substantial evidence, but she could conclude that the evidence did not prove by preponderance that they showed a reasonable likelihood of injury. The only evidence presented was the unsupported opinion of the inspector that the roof was, I guess, I don't know if you use the term reasonably likely to fall on a minor. But he really didn't explain anything about why that was reasonably likely that a minor in the positions minors would be in would have the roof fall on as a result of 2 feet or 3 feet deep cut in this particular case. So we, of course, have case law that says the judge may rely upon an inspector's opinion as the basis of finding substantial evidence. That lawyers always make things over dramatic, but it seems to me in this case we'd be tantamount to saying the judge must rely upon the inspector's unsupported opinion that something's significant and substantial. So once an inspector checks significant and substantial and is willing to come to hearing and say this was significant and substantial, that we really don't have any, we meaning the commission as a whole, don't have any role to play. The judges have to just go ahead and accept that no matter the lack of evidence proffered by the inspector for that position. Commissioner Young pointed out that the inspector, to a very large extent, undercut his own testimony by recognizing variations in the distance. So nobody wants a 22-foot cut where there's a 20-foot limit. But I think there has to be some showing that miners in the locations they are in or will be in would be reasonably likely to be hit by a roof fall. And he simply didn't, as far as I could see, provide sufficient testimony to overcome the judge's substantial evidence decision. You guys may talk about redundant safety measures. I won't get into that now. I think we're going to have to be careful going forward that redundant safety, this you can't use redundant safety features, doesn't swallow the S&S rule, that Matthews and Newtown don't go away in light of everything's S&S, because everything that might interrupt a reasonably serious injury is a redundant safety feature. I'm not sure what a redundant safety feature means. But since since at least at this point, I think this is a substantial evidence case, I don't have to get into it now, and I'll wait to listen to you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Oliphant. Commissioner Cohen?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Rory, for the memo that you wrote and your additional advice and insights. Excuse me. I agree that this is basically a substantial evidence case. But I would vacate the judge's decision on S&S and either remand or reverse. There's a basic principle in administrative law relating to the doctrine of substantial evidence that in reviewing the whole record, an appellate tribunal must consider anything in the record that fairly detracts from the weight of the evidence that supports a challenged finding. This is our boilerplate, and it comes from the Universal Camera Corp that the Supreme Court decided in 1951. I don't disagree with Commissioner Young about considering the specific facts in determining whether the particular situation, whether in the particular situation that's presented by the facts of the case, the violation, whether the hazard of a roof fall is S&S. But I think that there are critical facts which the judge did not consider, and which render it so that it is not supported by substantial evidence. First, there was in fact a roof fall associated with this particular deep cut. The hazard, which the judge properly identified at step two of the Matthews analysis, was not just reasonably likely to occur, it did occur. According to Mr. Hamilton, it occurred when the continuous miner punched through into entry number two. The roof fall was of significant size. According to the testimony, most of the fall landed on the continuous miner and broke the conveyor chain on the miner. But in addition to what fell on the miner, Inspector Ratliff measured 29 to 36 inches of rock on the left side of the crosscut and up to 42 inches of rock on the right side. Most importantly, the roof fall broke back. According to Mr. Bogg, the roof fall itself damaged three bolts which had been installed after the previous cut. I note that Inspector Ratliff indicated a belief that these bolts were damaged by the continuous miner. But here, Mr. Bogg actually did an investigation for Consol and wrote a report, which is in the record. And he describes exactly why, in that report, exactly why he thinks that, or he concluded that three bolts that had been installed in the previous cut were damaged by the roof fall, while one bolt was damaged by the continuous miner when it was trimming the roof, which was after the roof fall. Inspector Ratliff essentially speculated that the bolts were damaged by the miner. He found two bolts. He thought that they were both damaged by the miner rather than by the roof fall, and he said that because he did not see rock on the ground near the damaged bolts. But a good bit of time had elapsed between the rock fall and Ratliff's arrival on the scene, which was enough time to move the continuous miner out, have it trim the roof, and do some bolting. And it would seem probable that the rock which fell from the roof, which was described by the miners on the scene to Mr. Bogg, and which damaged the bolts, had been cleaned up by the time that Inspector Ratliff got there. So we have the fact of an actual roof fall which broke back and did what the judge said was not going to happen. Now, a second fact which was important to the inspector but ignored by the judge was recognized by Commissioner Young in his presentation, was that the deep cut terminated at the intersection with entry number two. Inspector Ratliff testified that a deep cut is more hazardous if it terminates at an intersection because there's less support provided for the roof. Now, looking at the concern, so those two facts I don't think were really considered. In fact, they weren't considered at all. I don't think the judge mentioned either of those two facts in her opinion. I could be wrong, but I don't think she mentioned either of those facts. The concern of Inspector Ratliff was not that miners would go under. Now, I'm going to begin talking now about the way the judge wrote her opinion here and why I don't think it was supported by substantial evidence. The concern of Inspector Ratliff was not that miners would go under the unsupported roof and be injured, but that the fall would break back into areas which had been bolted and injure miners there. Now, Mr. Boggs specifically agreed that it is necessary to be more cautious in adverse roof conditions, and clearly adverse roof conditions existed at this mine. And Mr. Boggs testified that it's not unusual at all for a roof fall to come out by the last installed row of bolts. And Mr. Hamilton also agreed that this can happen, although he didn't do it with as much elaboration as Mr. Boggs did. So with all this in mind, let's look at the judge's analysis of S&S at step three. First, she said that it, quote, it was unlikely that miners would have accessed the area affected by the hazardous condition, unquote, because they work a substantial distance from the unsupported roof and are not permitted to enter the red zone. And it seems to me that this finding by the judge is based on an understanding of the area affected by the hazardous condition being limited to the area of the deep cut itself. And that when she made this finding, she wasn't considering the breaking back of the roof fall into areas where miners could be. Now, the part of the finding about miners not being permitted to enter the red zone also assumes that miners won't enter it, and I think that the Secretary does have a point here. Not the conclusive point, perhaps, that the Secretary thinks it is, but there's a point that this is a questionable assumption. Now, there's a specific regulation, Section 75.202B, which makes going under unsupported roof a violation. And if the situation in the mines was such that the prohibition of miners going under unsupported roofs, such as is in Consol's policy, if that was sufficient, then you wouldn't need a regulation. And not only is there a regulation, but this is also one of MSHA's rules to live by. And I agree with Commissioner Young about the Secretary bringing all this other stuff that wasn't presented at the hearing and sticking it in the appellate brief. I think that probably deserves an opinion, a footnote in our opinion, whichever way we end up going on it. It's relevant to me. I don't know whether we should mention it or not, that it's in one of the rules to live by. And also, Inspector Ratliff testified that when he was a miner, he accidentally went under unsupported roof. Okay. Then the judge spoke about the continuous miner's ripper head and the ATRS on the roof bolting machine providing additional support. And the Secretary alleges that the judge relied on redundant safety features. I don't think we have to get into the redundant safety features argument here. I think it is much more relevant to note that if the roof fall breaks back into the areas which have been bolted, that portends some danger. And the safety features do not come into play if that happens. In other words, the ATRS is up in the area which is unsupported, and it's used to protect the bolters as they go moving through there and putting up bolts. That has nothing to do with what happens if there's a roof fall and it breaks back. Likewise, the ripper head. which is, I think, if I understood the record right, that comes into play if a miner goes up to the last row of bolts and put the ripper head up there to help support the bolt, the roof. But that also doesn't, I don't think, have much relevance to the concern that the inspector expressed here. Maybe it's worth noting, though, that this mine did experience a fatality of a roof bolter who had ATRS protection. This was testified to by the inspector as well as being put into the record on appeal by the Secretary's counsel. Then the judge made reference to the miner's tighter bolting pattern. And I think this is relevant, but it's a fragile basis on which to conclude that a roof fall resulting from the deep cut had little likelihood of resulting in injury. I would say that the tighter bolting pattern is probably why I'm not sure that it shouldn't be reversed. That could be a reason in my mind to remand rather than reverse here. I think it's important to notice that the tighter bolting pattern was not mentioned in this case until Mr. Boggs' redirect testimony at pages 312, 313. And that the benefits of tighter bolting were described in a series of leading questions to which Mr. Boggs simply said yes. That's not to say that that testimony isn't in the record and could be considered, but, you know, it's questionable whether how much weight can be attached to it. And despite the tighter bolting pattern, Mr. Boggs still had testified that he was concerned about a roof fall breaking back into the bolted area. And he testified that about that on at least two occasions, and he did it coming from himself rather than being led through it as the tighter bolting pattern stuff was done. The judge then said Inspector Ratliff provided no explanation as how a crack or roof fall would work its way back to where miners were located given the supplemental roof support and tighter bolting pattern that was being used. And I think this statement by the judge is the heart of the lack of substantial evidence in this decision. First, while the tighter bolting pattern is probably relevant here, I don't think the supplemental roof support is, for the reasons I mentioned a minute ago. The ATRS used in roof bolting would have nothing to do with a roof fall breaking back into a bolted area, and I don't think that the ripper head really would either. Second, while it's true that Inspector Ratliff did not explain his conclusion, which more accurately should be understood as the Secretary's trial counsel did not ask Mr. Ratliff why he had that belief, the judge failed to recognize that his testimony was uncontradicted. Both Mr. Bogg and Mr. Hamilton agreed with Inspector Ratliff on this point. Moreover, the evidence in the case is that the roof fall which occurred did break back into the bolted area and damage three bolts in the first row of bolts. The only question, to my mind, involves miners being there. But in this regard, the record is clear that the continuous miner operator went to the second to last row of bolts every 10 minutes to make gas checks. The second to last row of bolts was only 2.5 feet from the row which was damaged. That's because of the tighter bolting pattern. So I think this is a very strong argument that of a reasonable likelihood that a miner being put at that point, that close to what actually did happen at this mine, there was a roof fault, If that guy had been there when the roof broke back, he would have either been hit by the rock that fell, or it would have come within a foot of him. And I think if you look at that fact and the possibility that the breaking back could have gone past the first row of bolts to the second row of bolts where the miner actually was standing directly underneath, we should be looking at that as a reasonable likelihood of a miner being injured by a rock fall contributed to by this violation. And the judge simply ignored that way of looking at the evidence. The judge's last factual finding had to do with the length of time the hazard existed. And here the judge said, quote, "Furthermore, assuming that normal mining operations had continued without being interrupted by the issuance of the citation, the hazard condition would not have exposed miners to danger for a lengthy period of time because the unsupported roof was already being bolted by the time Inspector Ratliff arrived." I think that statement is erroneous in several ways. First, contrary to what the judge said, no mining operations were interrupted by the issuance of the citation. Inspector Ratliff waited until the bolting was complete before issuing the citation. Second, more importantly, the judge is looking at the time after the inspector's arrival without considering the time before he arrived. As of the time of Inspector Ratliff's arrival, the bolting was in process. He did not testify of a danger to miners at that time. He did not testify to a danger to miners in carrying out the bolting process. The danger was earlier, before the bolting of the cut commenced. There was danger at the time the roof fall occurred. And at this point, the cut was not complete. There was only what Mr. Hamilton referred to as a hole, an 8-foot hole in the coal wall which separated the cut from entry number 2. If I understand the record correctly, the miner had to be withdrawn from the cut after the roof fall because the conveyor chain had been broken. It had to be repaired. The rock from the roof fall had to be removed from the miner. Then the continuous miner had to be returned to the face to finish the cut because by the time Inspector Ratliff arrived, the cut was completed. The cross cut was completely into the entry. So the miner had to go back and finish that job, and then the miner had to be used to trim the roof before the bolting could begin. And we know that that happened also. We don't know, I don't think, although maybe it can be calculated, the period of time from when the roof fault occurred to the time that Inspector Ratliff arrived, but it seems to me that there was significant danger from the point of the roof fall until shortly before Inspector Ratliff arrived. In other words, shortly until the time of the commencement of the bolting process. Thus, I believe that the judge's decision as to S&S was not supported by substantial evidence and should be vacated. And I've not concluded yet whether the record compels a finding of S&S, although I think there's a good argument for that, or whether the S&S issue should be remanded to the judge. So.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. I would probably reverse the judge on the S&S finding. I think that it seemed to me that my two colleagues here, the first, you know, Commissioner Alvin and Commissioner Young, for the record, that your discussion centered on, you know, that the judge, given these facts, that maybe there was not a likelihood that the roof fall would occur because it was just a small amount of extra feet. They didn't really, you know, it just the small extra distance. But I don't see the judge's opinion as focusing on that at all. When I read her opinion on the S&S analysis, I see her as accepting that it went beyond the 20 feet standard, but assuming the roof fall occurred, it was not likely that anyone would get injured because they wouldn't be in the area that they could get injured, or they had the HRS support. And so that's what I focused on, and I disagree with. And I think I wonder, I mean, I don't see the judge's decision in the S&S part debating about how much, you know, would one extra foot or five extra foot beyond the required distance be more or less likely to lead to a roof fall. I mean, I don't see her getting into that. So I had that question posed for you because I sort of agree that, you know, Commissioner Young seemed to say, oh, if there had been a roof fall, then
that wasn't what I was saying. What I'm talking about is the type of roof fall that Commissioner Cohen was rightly concerned about, breaking back through the bolts in a very significant way. Because I understand what you're talking about. The reason the deep cut is dangerous is not because the roof out there in the area of the cut is going to fall. It's because it puts stress on the remaining bolted supported roof behind where you're cutting. So I understand that that's the concern. My question is, if you have a standard that says 20 feet, but it's really 22 or 23 feet, and that's where you are, how can you say something's dangerous if it's acknowledged by the inspector as a practical reality that could occur maybe with that being a violation? Now, the judge found it was a violation, it was greater than 20 feet. That's fine, but the inspector did say it could be greater than this. And the reason you start to look at all of these things together and the totality of the circumstances, I don't say that the secretary couldn't have proved it. I'm saying that you have to have an explanation of how those forces are going to work in this case. So I'm not saying, no, there's unlikely to be a roof fall. I'm saying the type of roof fall that you're concerned about, it is right there on the cusp of likelihood or unlikelihood, and the judge can make a decision, and she made a decision.
I disagree. I mean, first, when you open up, anytime you're opening up roof in the mine, I mean, you've got an issue of roof falling. So I'm not totally willing to disregard the fact that the open area, the extended cut, we don't have to worry about roof falling in the area of the extended cut. I think we can't disregard that. And in fact, as Commissioner Cohen pointed out, indeed there was fall as they broke into that entry. So I view this as they make a determination it's 20 feet. When you have adverse roof conditions, you're limited to 20 feet. To the extent you go beyond that, I think that you're putting in issue the possibility, the likelihood that that roof might fall in the deep cut area or break back. Now, if you were to require the secretary to start coming in and proving what would happen, you know, 1 foot, 2 foot, I mean, I've actually been in trials where that was an issue, and they had engineers with colorful charts that I'm sure the operator spent like zillions of dollars, and the trial lasted weeks, you know, in these two entry cases. What exactly were the stresses of the roof in three entries opened up versus two entries opened up, and why it was better to limit it to? And I mean, this is not something your average MSHA inspector is going to be able to do a helpful analysis of the stresses, you know, of what's happening.
I don't see why not. I mean, the harder a case is to prove, the harder you have to work to prove it. If it was 4 inches over the 20 feet, Do you think that you might need more evidence of what the problem was if it was 8 inches?
No, I mean, I don't think you can say, tell us why the roof is more. But anyway, in this case, let me go back to my point. The judge, she didn't deny S&S. She did not find S&S on that basis. So I'm looking at what she did here. And to me, she assumes, no, she didn't find that step mathy. She didn't say it's not likely. They failed to show that it was likely that a roof fall would occur. Her whole discussion is, assuming a roof fall occurred, nobody's going to be hurt by it. And that's where I zoomed in on, and I think she erred there, because one of her findings is, well, the roof bolters would not be injured because there's no reasonable likelihood of injury to them because they're protected by the ATRS. I find that very troubling. I mean, that would... I don't think that's true. I mean, I can't... I just cannot wrap my head around the fact that it would be a holding of the roof could fall, but the ATRS equipment there would preclude it from being S&S.
I'm not sure ATRS is redundant compared to like the tighter bolting, because you anticipate that these guys are going to be in proximity to unsupported roof because what they're doing is installing the roof support. So right. You have to have something, and to me it's not redundant. That's a primary safety measure. That's intended to ensure their safety while they're doing something in a hazardous situation. So, I'm not sure that particular fact bothers me as much as the from a redundancy standpoint is the tighter bolting pattern. I mean, I think the tighter bolting pattern is redundant, but I'm not sure the ATRS is.
I don't know. You know, to me, I just was uncomfortable. First of all, that ruling would preclude an S&S finding in any no deep cut, no matter how far beyond the requirement, would not be S&S because those bolters are going to have ATRS protection. So if the roof falls, the view is the roof falls, but you're okay with the ATRS. I don't see, I can't find it. Not okay, but it's not S&S because of the ATRS, so that was.
I just can't. Are we ready for discussion, or
yeah.
Well, somebody's interrupting the chairman's.
Yeah, somebody's interrupting the chairman's presentation.
Please forgive my poor man. I thought she asked.
Well,
I was trying to get.
We'll tweet at you that you're rude.
Sad.
Sad.
I was trying to explain that my perspective is not the likelihood of the roof falling, but what is the effect of that fall? I thought that was I just wanted to. But it seemed like, I don't want to repeat myself. Let me just see if there's anything else I have to say that. Well, I agree with Commissioner Cohen that the evidence is there that it did break back. And the judge seemed to, on the one hand, acknowledge that those broken bolts could have been caused by the roof fall breaking back. At the same time, disregarding that or ruling contrary to that in the S&S finding.
Well, what I was going to say is, are we at discussion?
Yeah.
If it was Administrative Law Judge Cohen on this case, he would have found S&S and I would have sustained it. Because he would have given enough support to say substantial evidence supports his finding. However, I don't think his recitation of facts here, I mean, to me it's a reweighing of the evidence, stressing things. For example, on his first point, the judge actually did say, the bolts were likely dislodged or otherwise damaged by the roof fall or by the contingency miner as it was trimming the roof afterward. So yeah. She simply chose to say, we can't be definitive on that. She did consider it and say she wasn't definitive on it. So it isn't that she ignored that testimony. She specifically dealt with it.
Right. But she acknowledged the possibility that it could be the fall of breaking back.
It could be the possibility.
Right.
I was going to get to that a little later, but both of you have used the word possibility. Repeatedly. It's reasonable likelihood, not possibility. If it becomes possibility, then they always just shut down mines because there's always a possibility somebody's going to get hurt in a mine. That's the way overstatement I hate lawyers to do. But what I say is it's reasonable likelihood, not possibility, and I think...
Which is why it should be probably remanded rather than reversed. Well, if it was more than possibility, then...
But I'm now out of the sequence. The ATRS, the roof control plan, which is the violation here, specifically says an approved ATRS, automated temporary roof support, ATRS system, is acceptable support during roof bolting operations. So the roof control plate specifies ATRS support during roof bolting operations. So I don't think we can disregard the ATRS, which is in the roof bolting plan, roof control plan, and support for the roof.
But I don't think it anticipates that the roof is going to be.
Well, but I think the key point is, the key point Commissioner Cohen raised was that the judge didn't consider the possibility of the roof breaking back into the bolted area or right up to the bolted area, and she did.
Not the possibility, the fact that it happened.
No, what
she
says.
The key fact is that it happened.
What she says is, Inspector Ratliff provided no explanation as to how a crack or roof wall would work its way back where miners were located. So, I mean, she makes a specific finding on that point. So, this is just a weighing of the evidence. To me, it's a weighing of the evidence. Had she gone the other way, I would have affirmed. I don't see how we reweigh the evidence here and make findings of S&S when the judge has weighed the evidence and found it not to be S&S unless there's a legal error. And I don't see the legal error here.
The judge did not weigh the evidence. The judge did not consider the key fact in the case.
What's the key? That it had broken back?
It had broken back.
She says it may have broken back to the roof, or it may have been due to continuous mining. She did consider the fact that it may have.
Well, it's not
maybe she
broken
did.
Back.
Maybe she
did break back.
Maybe she didn't consider it to your satisfaction, but she did consider it. You would have put more weight on that. She didn't put as much weight on it. It had to hit him. There's no evidence that any miner was ever did a methane check. It's every 10 minutes. He doesn't say any miner was. There's no evidence a miner actually went to the last row of roof bolts during the period of the deep cut. No evidence about that. So how does that he goes up to every 10 minutes mean anything? It's just surplusage. They could have proved this case, and maybe they did for some judges prove it. For you, they proved it. For Judge Ray, they didn't prove it. I think we just got to give Judge Ray the credence of being the trial judge in this case. That's my point.
My thing on the methane check, I mean, there was evidence that was brought in that they used a probe, but kind of a long probe.
Well, yeah, they used a big probe, yeah, too.
To take the...
They used a 24-foot long probe.
But that, I mean...
From the second to last bolt.
From the second last bolt. No, I agree.
They were under the second last bolt.
If they did it. Do you know they did one?
Well,
you're assuming they did one.
You think for these hours and hours and hours when they're supposed to do it every 10 minutes consolidation?
Well, you're saying hours and hours and hours. We don't know that it's hours and hours and hours. By the way, after the first roof bolt, after the first set of roof bolts was put in, it's no longer a deep cut, right? I know you're saying it had to back out and go in again. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, but that's right. And I said specifically, Bill, that once the bolting started, we're not in this
hazard
anymore.
I thought you said once they finished bolting.
I said once the inspector got there in the midst of the bolting,
right.
He did not perceive any danger. That's right. There wasn't any danger as of
the time period. I think we can agree on this. Then the time period is from when they crossed the 20-foot threshold to when the next row of roof bolts was, the fresh set of roof bolts was put in.
Yeah.
We agree on that. Anyway, I just think this is, it's a reweighing of the evidence, and the judge did consider all these things. Is there evidence that she did consider? And she simply said they didn't prove the case. I mean, and that happens. I mean, they probably could have proved the case. Maybe for some judges they did prove the case, but not for this judge. And it's a substantial evidence case. She gets to make the call. I mean, if we start reversing S&S cases by us reweighing the evidence up here, it just destroys the whole system of adjudication by the ALJs.
No, it doesn't.
What should they be doing there? They will be so afraid to find anything not S&S because we'll be reversing them by some fact that they may or may not have considered that everything will become S&S because they think they're going to get reversed by a commission who will not find anything to not be S&S, even though they found it.
No.
See, I think the opposite concern I have is that if you say, regardless of whether a roof fall would occur, no miners are...
No, it's where the miners would be, where the roof fall would occur.
Well, no, I'm looking at... She's saying a roof fall might occur. You know, the deep cut, yes, it could lead to a roof fall. But no miners would be endangered. And the reason she puts for that could apply virtually anywhere. No deep cut, no matter how long, could be S&S under review.
I don't think... What she said was... Not that no miner would be in danger. She said the secretary did not prove a reasonable likelihood that a miner would have the roof fall on. That's what she said.
And the things that she relied on as to why they did not prove it, I think would be applicable in virtually every case.
I don't think so.
They're using ATRS systems, equipment. Well, that's going to be
well, that carries
everywhere.
This whole redundant safety thing.
They're in certain locations, except when they do, you know, get their back. So I don't see anything. So I'm sitting here thinking, well, under this view, I mean, I understand your problem. We can't sort of micro, you know, second guess and reweigh the evidence. But I think what we got here is there's no such thing as an S&S deep cut.
That's not true at all. You get deep cut, you fall. Go back and look. Judge Barber wrote a case. I think actually it was a Knox Creek case back in 2000, where their plan said you can take 35-foot cuts unless there's adverse roof. The adverse roof provision was almost identical to what you had here, and then you're limited to 20 feet. The operator decided, it's not adverse roof. We're just going to go ahead and cut as normal. Well, there was huge roof fall. And you look at that, a case is easy to prove. This case is hard to prove because the incursion, the
now
variance...
Now, why would it be S&S? So in the one you describe, you say it would be S&S?
Yeah, because
why?
Because as Judge Barber explained, he said because
was
of the deep cut, it
any?
Increased the likelihood of a roof fall that would injure minors.
How would the roof fall injure minors?
Because it broke back
under
in
her.
A huge way. I mean, they were almost double what they were allowed to mine under those conditions. They should have known, as he said, that there was adverse roof, and they mined almost double. And then it wasn't just the roof out there and the deep cut falling. Broke back, it was a serious problem. It's not hard to demonstrate that it can happen. This is engineering, this is persuasion, this is facts. In this case, you have the inspector saying, well, yeah, you could possibly, right about at the break line here of where they decided this was, you could be in compliance with your roof control plan, maybe at 22 or 23 feet, maybe. And that's where the judge found they were. How could you be in compliance if it's a deadly hazard? MSHA's not going to permit you to have a deadly hazard. But at 35 feet, you can really explain the engineering pressures and the stress and everything in a way. It's harder to explain something when the stress may not be as great. Like I said, the intersection thing, that's a compelling fact. I really did think about that. And I think that's the kind of thing that you build a case on. The judge found the secretary didn't do enough building. And I'm going to affirm her on those grounds, even though I think you've made some excellent points. But I don't agree that you can never show that one of these cases. I mean, I think this is just a case where you look at how a case is decided, and you go back. I mean, one of the things I've gone out and talked to industry groups, and I say, you know what you can really do to help yourself? Win your case. But here, I don't fully agree with Commissioner Alton, but I have a concern that there's never going to be enough that they could do to win the case and have it stand up. And there's going to be in a position where you can never win a case, and where the secretary, who is already constantly pressuring us to assume this and assume that, drag in facts after the fact, and try to get to the easy way and that's what the government does. The government goes out there and they bring the hammer and the leverage and deference and everything they can to avoid having to get out there and roll up their sleeves and try the case and win the case on the merits sometimes.
But in this case, the roof fall occurred and it broke back. If that hadn't happened, we'd be in a very different situation and I could well be agreeing with you. It's very important to the commission that the facts of the case be looked at. And I'm not saying that every deep cut is automatically S&S. You look at, especially if it was only 2 feet over, You look at the facts. This was very bad roof, apparently. And it did break back in a very significant way. That is, I mean, you look at those facts, and that's what makes this situation at this mine with these extra 2 feet, arguably S&S.
Yes, it was arguably S&S. That's just not what the judge found.
I know,
what evidence is there that the original, I'll take it as a given, there was a break back, even though she says this testimony is inconsistent in terms of how those bolts were damaged. She finds it was either mining, so that's her factual finding on it. But let's take it as, maybe that led
to... No, I don't think she talked about breaking back at all.
Well, she talked about the damaged roof bolts. I thought that's what you're going on, the damaged roof bolts. She talked about the damaged roof bolts.
Let's look at it. Where are we talking about?
This is what she should have been doing with her law clerk. Page... 2408. Oh, do you have the...
No, what's the other page number? I got the other.
The other page is right after...
It's on my page 14. It's the gravity and S&S fine.
Well, I'm looking at the violation.
Okay, a few pages before.
Before, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
On the... It's in the next page after she begins violation. The paragraph that starts first, consult witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
The next to the last sentence of that paragraph is, the bolts were likely dislodged or otherwise damaged by the roof fall or by the continuous miner as it was trimming the roof afterward, as Hamilton and Ball stated. So she said one or the other.
And she said that in the context of a paragraph which is dealing not with the hazard, not with the danger. Let me finish. She's putting it in the paragraph where she's talking about whether there was a violation at all, was a contested fact at the hearing.
But those are facts she certainly was taking into account in her decision.
No, we don't have any reason to believe that she was taking let me finish my sentence, okay? She didn't put it into her S&S analysis.
You have to repeat everything you find in every element of your decision.
If it's the critical fact, you do, yes.
How do we know that that first roof fall, wherever it was, didn't alleviate the danger of a subsequent roof fall? You're assuming that the first roof fall proves it's more likely than not that it's going to fall back in over the miners. Maybe it made it less likely. I mean, are you an engineer? Do you know that?
That's not what the consult witnesses testified to. They said they were very, very concerned about that.
They said there'd
been... About a breaking back.
What I'm saying is this is just a factual decision by the judge, and there's no basis for us to just say, judge, you're wrong. I mean, let's not just overturn our judges just because we don't like their decisions.
Bill, I'm not just overturning our judges.
You just don't like their decision.
No. No, don't say that.
Oh, that's true.
All right.
Don't punch me.
I need my gavel. All right.
No, that's an accusation. It's really unfair.
What?
I'm looking at the facts of the case.
And she looked at the facts of the case.
No, not when she analyzed S&S.
She may not have put enough down to satisfy you, but she looked at the facts of the case and made a rational decision, a reasonable decision. It's one a reasonable person should agree with, and one we should not just go ahead and overturn because we don't agree with it.
If she said, here it is. The bolts were likely dislodged or otherwise damaged by the roof fall. So she said either one was potential.
Right.
But then I think she based her S&S decision on that nobody would be. The break back wasn't.
She based her decision, I apologize. She based her decision on a finding that the secretary had not proved that it was reasonably likely there would be a roof fault on miners. That's her decision.
She said,
they didn't
prove
it was reasonably likely there would be a roof fault on miners. We should all agree that's her decision.
She said, so that, you know, she said he didn't explain
you
how.
You don't agree
that. No, I do. That was her decision.
Yeah. So then the question is, should we reverse that decision because she didn't consider.
Or remand, vacate evidence. And remand.
But what would the remand say? You have to consider things you didn't consider when I think she did consider?
She didn't consider it for S&S purposes. That was the hazard. That was the.
That's like the judges just say, okay, here's the facts that are relevant to the violation. I put those aside, but I'm forgetting all those. Now I'm going to the S&S. I don't know. It's getting into how the judge writes her decision. I mean, the question is there enough here to sustain a decision that they didn't prove it? Which means in the case of where they didn't prove it is, did they surely prove this case so that it's the decision has to be reached? No reasonable person could find other than this was S&S. I don't think that's true. A reasonable person, Judge Ray, found it was not S&S, and she cited facts to support that.
In reviewing the whole record, an appellate tribunal must consider anything in the record that fairly detracts from the weight of the evidence that supports a challenge.
I agree. I completely agree with that. That is our boilerplate, and I completely agree with that. And Commissioner Cohen, when I said that, I didn't mean to make that as an accusation. It was more like, how do I explain it? I didn't mean to say that you were not making a very intelligent, cogent statement of a position here. I think it is. I simply think that a reasonable judge, based on this evidence, could reach the decision she reached, and therefore it passes substantial evidence test, even taking into account the things you've discussed today.
All right. Well, as we stand now, we're 2-2, so anything we say in the written opinions are basically, you know, I guess there'll be two opinions.
Should we wait for a fifth commissioner to be appointed?
Yeah.
I don't think this case is important.
No, yeah, I agree.
I know. I think some agencies do that, but then it's so you get the aging. Yeah.
No,
we
shouldn't wait.
If we have two opinions, I guess there's even something to think about. I'm not necessarily proposing or pushing one way or the other. I suppose there's even the option of not issuing much opinion-wise and just say that we were divided and the judge's decision stands affirmed. I think historically the commissioners have issued opinions.
I can't conceive of a commissioner going one to take that.
Well, I throw it out there just I'm not even sure I'm saying to take it, but I think obviously some adjudicatory bodies do. And at least it gets it out there and it doesn't get hung up where the end result is. Nothing that either opinion says is sort of precedent, but it does put views out there, I guess, in case for future reference or in case the case goes further. All right. I'm not sure at this point we need to get much further because I'm not sure how the writing should happen. I mean, I think Commissioner Cohen, you and I have to talk even further. I'm not even sure where we need to talk to see how we would work out to be on one opinion. And then in terms of...
If I may interject, Rory wrote an excellent memo, mm-hmm. and he's also assists Commissioner Cohen as his counsel, so it seemed to me Rory would be logically the person to write your view of it, but I have no
I agree. I'll talk to the general counsel and Rory. I mean, I generally take the view, I don't really think it's a good idea to have an attorney draft the opinion. That's the opposite of what what they concluded when they reviewed the record and the law in it the first go around. It has happened, and people are,
that's called being a lawyer.
That's being a lawyer, you know? But since we don't have to do that here, we have probably ample other opportunities. But why don't we assume that for the time being, and then why don't you kind of talk with me and Mike McCord about it? Sounds like you and Commissioner Young are fairly in sync for one opinion.
I think so, yeah.
And so maybe you could discuss who might draft that, on that opinion, and get back to me and Mike McCord, and then we'll talk further how we might get something issued. All right. With that, we'll go off the record.